And generally keep yourself muted. There will be opportunities to ask questions. And at that time, you'll probably be called on. You can use the raise hand function. And if you're not sure where the raise hand function is, depending on what version of Zoom you're using, it could be under the reactions button now, or it may still be on the participants list. And so you can, there's old one, it used to be on the participants list, newer ones, it's on the reactions option when you float over the window. So you can ask a question, raise your hand, and you'll get called on. And at that time, you can unmute yourself to ask. But at this time, unless there's any specific questions, I'll turn it over to John Hornstein to introduce the speaker. And then we'll do club business afterwards.
Thank you. It's a very great pleasure to introduce Tom Field, our speaker this evening. He majored in computer science at Tufts University and at the University of Washington, and he's an avid amateur astronomer. He's a contributing editor at Sky and Telescope magazine, and as an amateur, he felt the need for tools to enable amateur astronomers like himself to easily record and plot and analyze the spectra of astronomical objects. With the tools he developed, you can measure the spectra of rather exotic things, not only planets, but also supernovae and quasars, and maybe probably planetary nebula. And his tools even enable amateurs to measure the Doppler shifts of these objects. He's created a company, Field Tested Systems, to make these tools widely available and to show people how to use them. So Tom, it's over to you.
Thanks, John. Great introduction. I appreciate the, you know, a lot of the background work that you do and Elizabeth do and others administering the club sometimes is unrecognized. So I just want to give you a shout out because, you know, it's not just one email or phone call to make a talk like this happen. There's a whole folder of emails that I've got that you and I've exchanged. Where did you find, and not that it's a problem, where did you find my academic history online? Facebook, it would be the only place I can think of.
No, I did a more general web search.
Oh, okay. Well, good for you. Thanks for the introduction. It was a nice one. Good evening, everybody. Thanks so much for inviting me tonight. I'm going to talk for, 50 minutes or so, and then we'll just have Q&A. I appreciate the opportunity to talk. I'll tell you a little bit about my history as we get into my presentation. In fact, let's just do that. Let me share my screen and we'll get the show on the road. There we go. So if you can't see a prism there, let me know and I'll figure out why not. Let me get my screen laid out a little bit. One of the things, and since I'm in Seattle, I can complain about while I'm doing that about Microsoft is Microsoft forces me to tell it I want to have my cursor visible all the time, every single time I come in. It's like, give me a break, you know, remember something. But anyway, I love your logo here. And the 1937 was interesting to see. I didn't know that about the club. That's fantastic. So how have we managed to discover so much about the universe when, you know, we really haven't set foot outside our own home? We can get images of two dimensions, and we've been doing that for more than a century, of course. And we can get fleeting glimpses of a third dimension, and we've been doing that, again, for centuries. But if we wait a while in the fourth dimension, we can see things changing. You can see in the upper right-hand corner, for example, some of the stars changing in intensity, and these are some of our standard candles that we use. And if we spread the colors out, we get an as-if fifth dimension. Aesthetically, it's beautiful, and those gaps have an enormous amount of information in them. And they can reveal about our star as well as other stars, you know, not only composition. And I'll show you, by the way, probably during the Q&A, how these three lines, which are called the magnesium triplet and the sodium doublet, are something you could show during outreach star parties during the day. if you're doing hydrogen alpha outreach. It's a pretty cool device and can augment your standard outreach. These barcodes show us tons of stuff. I'm not going to read the bullets. I'm not as dumb as I look, but we'll talk about a lot of these as we go through tonight. So a little bit of history just to get everybody to the same level. This will just take a few minutes. So Sir Isaac Newton, of course, is the one who is credited with discovering that we could split light in a prism into its component colors. You can also bounce light off a finely grooved or finely lined surface, or even put that light through a finely grooved transparent grating, for example. And that's what we'll be talking about tonight. Now, Bunsen, we're all familiar with his name, perhaps, invented the Bunsen burner to burn stuff, put the light through a prism, and then look at the results. And he was a real pyromaniac. He burnt everything he could find. And the cool thing is he kept a great catalog. And we'll see some examples of that as we go forward tonight. This guy, Kirchhoff, we won't get much into detail about him tonight. He was a colleague and a friend. And I suppose those two, it would be redundant if I was to say, and also a contemporary. So, but the one thing I do want to mention about Kirchhoff is that he talked about how there's two different types of spectra we can get. And we're going to see examples of those tonight as we go through. Some are spectra which have, you know, a continuous background with gaps. And then there's some that just have lines. But regardless of which of those two you get, you're going to see that there's they're in the same position, whether they're emission or absorption lines, those actual features. Now, which you get depends on things Kirchhoff talked about, like temperature of gases and things like that, but we need not go there. Now, the next slide I used to have in my presentation was a whole bunch of bullets I added last year or the year before, because I realized I wanted to give people a heads up as to what I was going to talk about. But bullets put people to sleep, so I've eliminated that list, but I still want to call my audience, that would be you, call your attention to points that I think are important that I want to make during my talk. And to do that, I've got this little ding moment. And that just means this is something that used to be on that bulleted list. And in exchange for my not boring you with it with the next slide, you'll pay a little bit extra attention when I do a ding. That's the deal we've got. So these chemicals, these spectra are unique, like a fingerprint for different elements. So we can see here, for example, that hydrogen has a very strong line there that just doesn't show up in helium. Now, hydrogen is so commonly used that we've named the lines that we see in hydrogen in the spectrum as the Balmer lines and actually given them Greek names. So this, for example, hydrogen beta, we'd call it. That's, let's call that robin egg blue, okay? And here's an example of a poster that I made a few years ago. We sell it mostly to educators, but some amateurs buy it also. And you can see here for hydrogen, there's the hydrogen alpha. There's that robin egg blue hydrogen beta. And those lines are very different. If you went into a flower shop and you got an inflatable balloon and then somehow safely burnt the contents of it that were helium, you would see lines like these, very different than hydrogen. So We don't have to burn things in the same way that Bunsen did, or we'd have a lot more house and lab fires, I suppose. Now we have, and I've got one over here on my messy desk. I'm always thinking, like, what can they see back there that would embarrass me? I can't think of anything, but I'm always a little nervous when I turn around. A little bit of prep would go a long way. But this is it's just a lamp. It's a gas tube that, you know, like a fluorescent gas tube or a neon light at a pizza joint. If they still have neon lights on them, I think they maybe have all gone to LEDs now. So now, some years ago, I created, and it's been really popular with educators, this little tripod-mounted camera. You can see it on the screen there. And it uses the same software. And here, for example, you can see this is a hydrogen gas tube. So there's a hydrogen alpha. There's that robin egg blue hydrogen beta, and so forth. So far, everyone I've spoken of have been old white men. So in order to redress that imbalance, although it can't be done in one slide, and certainly not in the next 60 seconds compared to the many millennia, perhaps, or certainly centuries that's been happening, here's some women who in the field have made a huge difference. Annie Jump Cannon and her group of women called computers were prohibited from accessing the telescopes at Harvard. So what they ended up doing was they studied the glass plates, the photographic plates of spectra, and they were really good at it. And they classified hundreds and hundreds of thousands of spectra. And over time, they began to see patterns and came up with a star classification scheme that actually worked, unlike the ones that were previous to them. Now, you might wonder, this is almost TMI. I was at my sleep apnea doctor yesterday for my sleep apnea device. And I was talking about all the data that they get, because my sleep apnea machine, CPAP machine, phones home every morning with all my stats to the company that makes it. I said to him, think of that treasure trove. He said he has prescribed 40,000 CPAP machines in his life, in his career. And that's just one person, one doctor. But he said to me something that reminded me of this slide, and I shared it with him. And that is, he said, because I was saying, if we could just mine that data with machine intelligence, heck, if we can drive cars, we should be able to extract all sorts of information with computers. By driving cars, I mean driving them with a computer. So he said, the thing is, and there's a long discussion that might go into this, that somehow it takes a human getting a massive amount of data before they begin to see patterns. And I think that these women were in a position to do that, which is one of the reasons they were able to come up with this scheme, because they began to see those patterns. And they also had a deep understanding of the topic. So in addition to them, we've got Priyamvada Nataraja here. She's from Yale. She studies hyperactive black holes has been really a successful researcher. Nancy Grace Roman, many of us are familiar with her name. She was the first astronomer at NASA, and she got her PhD in the late 1940s. I imagine she was the only woman in her graduating class. She was a big proponent of the Hubble Space Telescope, and we have her to thank for helping make it happen. Elisa, and I'm laughing because the captions that are automatically going up were covering her name. I've said her name a lot, but I had to squint a bit to remember. Elisa Quintana studies exoplanets and has discovered some going around a cooler star right at the right distance where there might be liquid water, which could contribute to the success of life. And finally, Jedediah Eisler studies gravitational lensing of black holes. She's at Dartmouth. So these are just some examples I put together last year. It was an exciting bit of research because there's so many other women that have made huge contributions. So we're making a very small need to make more progress in this way, but I thought you might be interested to see these contributors. Tonight, mostly what we're going to talk about is this little 1¼-inch grating called a star analyzer grating. And this is one of those ding moments because I think one of the misnomers about getting into spectroscopy, to doing science using the colors of stars with their spectra, is that, oh, it costs a lot. $200 is nothing. In fact, I was helping the plane wave people at a conference carry in one of their, 32-inch telescopes or something. You know, there are these carbon fiber telescopes, but they're big enough it takes two or three people to carry them in. And I said to them, you know, as we're carrying them in, as an exhibitor, I had a booth, they had a booth. It was at the SAS conference in LA, if you're familiar with that. A great science conference for amateurs. Some of the highest level of astronomical science being done by amateurs is done by that group. And I said to them, how much does this thing cost? They said, oh, I don't remember, $35,000. So I said to them, so when my wife and I are sitting around the kitchen table debating whether to raise the cost of my software from $99 to $109, that's not really going to impact your customers in terms of whether they buy my software. The point is, it's really inexpensive to get started. And there's lots of ways to use the grating. Almost any visualized or visualizing photography system. So over here, we have it screwed onto the lens cap threads with this little adapter that we sell of a DSLR. And you can do some fun spectra with that. It's best to have tracking, but you can even do it without tracking. In fact, we had a Zoom session for RSpec users this morning. There's a young woman in her early 20s who's just been setting the world on fire. She uses a 10-inch Dob with no tracking and video and the star analyzer grating and gets astonishingly high resolution spectra. I mean, she's doing all sorts of cool stuff. This is just any old Fitz camera, cool, uncool, doesn't matter. The one on the lower right there is a ZWO video camera like this one here. Can be color, can be a mono. Mono's a little more sensitive, but if you're doing outreach or education, I prefer the color for reasons I'll show you in a few minutes. And this is just an example of where you can mount it inside the filter rule. So again, it's sort of a ding moment. Is not only is it inexpensive, but it's really easy to mount. I mean, there could be inexpensive things that are a real hair puller, which could be a problem for some of us, you know, to get them right. But the grating is, you know, you don't really need a lot of extra hardware or any fancy fabrication skills. It just threads on. And we'll talk a little bit more of that at the end. You can piggyback a DSLR if you want to multitask with your telescope. Okay, so now we're done with the history, theory, and equipment. Thanks for bearing with me as we went through that. What can we actually do? Isn't that really what we want to do? Is we want to do some science with our telescopes. So if you have the star, starlight coming through your telescope or your camera, meaning your DSLR lens, and you go through a grating, it splits it into a spectrum, and this is what you see on your sensor. Let's look at our first example. This is a beautiful example. It's a captured by Torsten Hansen, but if you look at the top here, it is a very modest telescope and an imaging source video camera, which is sort of a generation back from the new ZWO cameras and their ilk. So these are different spectra captured at different times by Torsten. So, you know, one of the bullets I showed you a few minutes ago showed that one of the things that we can do with spectra is tell star temperature. And if you look on the left here, we can see these are the hot stars. They're in temperature order. Hot stars at the top, the B stars, and then they're in Obiofine G KM order with the cool type M stars at the bottom. So two quick examples here. One is, look at that, those lines. They're not even lines. That's like a forest, right? It's a band of lines. So what the professionals tell us is that on a relatively cool object, like a cooler type M star or a planet, a complex molecule may survive because it's just not that hot. And a complex molecule may generate, instead of just the lines like this, the simple elements, may generate some interesting bands. Now, if I could find my mouse, there we go. These are an example of those bands. So the other example I wanted to show you on this screen is this region here. It's in the robin egg blue. So in fact, that is our hydrogen beta line, which we'll see a little bit more about in just a moment. Notice how it's a stronger line right here. Right? It's wider, it's darker. Why would that be? Well, these are the hotter stars and these are the cooler stars. And neither of them, neither of those categories is as dark a line as this. Just a really quick review of how these lines, how these fingerprints get produced. This is definitely a ding moment because I think one of the misperceptions people have about spectroscopy with their telescope is that, well, you need to have a PhD in physics or astrophysics or, you know, there's a lot of math involved, a lot of theory. No. Listen, if a knuckle dragger like me can do this stuff, I don't have one of those advanced degrees. I don't have a science degree as an undergraduate. So the thing is that you learn as much as you care to learn. And in my case, look, I'm a one-trick pony. This is a great trick I'm showing you tonight, but it's a one trick. It's a single trick. So there's lots of things I don't know. As you'll hear in the Q&A session, if you challenge me with questions I don't have answers to, I'll be the first to admit, I don't know. So, but again, just briefly, the way that we get these fingerprints is you recall with the Bohr model of the atom, we have numbered shells with electrons going and orbiting around different numbered shells. And sometimes when there's energy added, like from the core of a star, those electrons jump between shells. Now in hydrogen, when they jump from level 2 to level 4, you get this robin egg blue absorption. The way I think of it is to grab an electron and pull it out of an atom takes energy. And that's why we get this gap, because we've pulled some energy out. So now, suppose the star is a hotter star like these B stars. Well, then when the electron gets pumped up by that starlight, it might go right past level 4 to level 5 or beyond. So there aren't as many electrons making that transition from 2 to 4 on these hot stars. And on the other end, these cooler stars, a lot of the electrons just don't get pumped up to level 4. They might make it up to level 3. So that's how the differences in temperature get exhibited by the differences in line width here. And frankly, amateurs don't spend a lot of time looking at line width and darkness. And I mean, we can, but certainly not early on. It's a little bit more technical to get that quantitative, but we'll see a lot of quantitative tonight. You need not worry about whether we're going to be scientific. Now, you know, my wife says that you're supposed to dress for success here. So somehow I don't think this is what she had in mind. In fact, truth be told, I know this isn't what she had in mind because she's told me more than once. So, but you know, it's all about color and spectroscopy, right? And if you look like here, there's that hydrogen alpha region there. And if you look down there, right down at the bottom, I know some of you at home are going to know what I'm talking about. These last 13 tough months, some of you have seen on yourselves or other partners a little gray area down at the base there. And the, look, the salons aren't open and they're now they're scheduled up. And do I really want to go? So anyway, there's light and color everywhere we look in our lives. But let's move on to talking about qualitative versus quantitative data. If you look in that region right there, maybe you can spot, it sort of looks like maybe there's a little dimming. Now, suppose by some quirk and mistake, I got time on the Hubble Space Telescope. And I captured a spectrum and I tried to publish a paper and I said, yeah, there was a little dimming in the robin egg blue. I'm not gonna get published, right? So to be quantitative, we need to measure that barely discernible dimming. And so what we do is we take this spectrum and we just do an intensity plot. Now stick with me here. So this axis here on the left is just intensity. How bright is the thing? Some of the starlight goes right through the grating straight. It doesn't get bent into the rainbow. And that's what we're seeing here. It's very bright and narrow. So this peak here is very high and very narrow. Now this thing over here, the spectrum itself, well, it's pretty dim in the wings, and here in the center, it's brighter. So what we have here is it starts out dim, gets brighter, 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 dimmer, dimmer, dimmer. But check this out. Look at that dip down there. Isn't that cool? So something we could barely spot here is really easily seen here. So how do we get this graph? So my story is in, you know, I started in the early 1990s in astronomy, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a few more minutes, but in 2009, I decided I wanted to like be the right stuff like Elizabeth and some of the other people here who are professionals in the field. I wanted to do some science. And to be honest, photometry just didn't interest me at all. And so I got one of these star analyzer gratings and I put it on my telescope. I went, listen, right outside here, I'm 3 miles from downtown Pike Place Market in Seattle. And right in the yard there, I took my C8. It was August. It was actually a Logitech webcam. And what I'd done is taken the barrel off of an eyepiece and duct taped it onto the spherical cam. And somehow I got it all right. It was just blind luck because I break most things I touch. I came in at midnight, my blue jeans had what, grass stains on the knees? Cause you know, it's Vega in August. What do you expect, right? So next morning, Sunday morning, I was all ready to take, and this literally is an image from that first night. I wanted to graph. I downloaded the freeware that was out there and it was really frustrating. What's worse than software crashing is when it crashes with an error message in another language that you don't know. It just wasn't up to the level of usability that we've all become accustomed to over the last 2 or 3 decades. So what did I do? I gave up. I really did. I told my wife, I said, I'm not having fun. And this is a hobby. I'm supposed to have fun. So I took the grating and I put it in a drawer. Honest truth here. But it kept bugging me over the next couple of weeks. And I decided, look, I've been writing software since the 1960s, literally. And that's a brag. It's about the only brag you'll hear from me tonight. Of course, seniority doesn't mean meritocracy. It doesn't mean I'm that good at it. I've been making the same mistakes now for 4 or 5 decades. But so I decided next weekend, next Saturday, I'm going to write a program to create this graph. And I did. Sunday morning, it was done. And now, 12 years later or so, 10 or 15,000 hours later, it's almost done. My wife keeps saying, would you finish the software so that we can have dinner at a normal hour? It's done. But I think, and this is definitely a ding moment, I actually should just go like this. One of the things about learning something new in any field, especially this one, is there's always this, another learning curve as I learn new software. I mean, it's a challenge, right? I mean, maybe the masochists amongst us like learning new software, and eventually it's fun because we've learned it. But and the reason I mention that is because I want to eliminate that obstacle in terms of your thinking about whether this would be something for you to do. Now, it's after dinner there, and so I know better than doing a full-blown software demo. You know, I can see some of your video cameras over here, and I know if I did a full demo, I'd start seeing the tops of people's heads and hearing the clunk as your unmuted mics were impacted by foreheads. But I don't want to not show you the software. So 2 minutes here in less than a dozen clicks. This is my software. This is an image. It could have come from a Fitz camera. So you could use your regular imaging software and just have that static Fitz or JPEG or TIFF image automatically loaded into my software. Or if you've got a video camera, this can be live under the stars at a star party. I mentioned that I wanted to talk about that a little bit. This can augment our standard showpieces that we use in star parties. And it gives you a chance, it gives you a platform to talk a little bit about the science. Now, again, you don't have to, you know, be a PhD or an undergraduate, you know, or a professional scientist. You know, as you've done do this, as you've done it for a short while, you pick up enough that you can talk with the public. And what you'll find interesting is a lot of people these days have seen, you know, they'll say, oh yeah, wasn't that in one of the early Cosmos series with Tyson, Neil deGrasse Tyson? And yeah, it was. So you can see a gap there and there and there, and there's the star. And as I said, I like color for outreach because it's a lot more intuitive than just a mono smudge. So all we do with the software is bracket the region that we want to study, and the software extracts that intensity information between the orange lines. So this peak is the data from the star, and this from dim, brighter, 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 dimmer, dimmer, dimmer. See that dip that right there? That's that gap right there. Wow. It is literally that easy. But so what? I feel somewhat like a dip talking about these dips. I'm working on that line. I haven't gotten the right line yet. It's the second time I've tried it. I'll work harder on it. The thing is, who cares? What are all these dips? Where do we go to sort of understand what we're seeing? Well, remember I mentioned Bunsen was a pyromaniac, burnt lots of things, looked at their spectra, and he kept a catalog. Well, the great, 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 great grand catalog is used all over the place, including in my software today. So let's take a look at that catalog. I can come up here and say to the software, show me on the graph with an overlay where the hydrogen bomber lines would produce dips in intensity. And wow, we've got some matches there, there, there. Isn't that amazing? So those dips are being caused by the hydrogen on that star as the starlight leaves the star. And we're detecting it with a $200 grating in our backyard. This is actually a freeze frame of a video, which plays at 2 frames per second from that very first night I was out. I want to play it for just a moment here, just check on something. There it is. You can see it's jumping around a little bit here, of course, because our scene is moving or changing. And you can see it changing here. And the features actually come and go. Let's turn off this fill. Last thing I want to show you, there's a feature right there that at 2 frames per second sort of comes and goes. You know, you can sort of see something's there, but we're not really good at integrating data that way. Built into the software for video is a simple averaging type stacking. And you can see over a period of 5 seconds after I turned it on, that feature rounds out, becomes symmetrical. Isn't that amazing? That's how beautiful stacking is and how effectively it can work. So we're gonna leave the screen. What I want, one last thing, if you would, is if you would just remember, wrong button, that screen. In your mind's eye, just set it aside. So there's some absorption features, and these are the hydrogen bomber lines caused by it. Hydrogen is those electrons are jumping around. Because we're going to see some cool science that uses this in the next handful of minutes. So let's come back here to the show. That we would do this way. So this is what I was saying about a star party. This is actually in Marseille in France. They were looking at gas tubes, but they transitioned to a star. But you can see there's a ton of light pollution. And that makes another ding moment. And that is that one really great thing about spectroscopy is it really is much less affected by light pollution than the kinds of imaging that we're all familiar with. And that's because we're just looking for those dips, those absorption or emission features. And so all the subtle gradations and color balance and all of that, that we are interested in visual imaging, we don't really care here. And so it's the kind of thing, especially since I sort of was a leading question whether you had a dark sky site there. I assumed in the heart of what would we call it, Metromica or something, the metro corridor back there, that it was tough to get to a dark sky site. So this is the kind of thing that you can actually do in a driveway. So here's an image of, just to show you what a full sky image would look like with a DSLR, rather wide field. You can see there's three stars here, three spectra with some gaps. Down here is a star and there's some lumps, right? And it's not the technical term, but these are just saturated pixels. In fact, let's look at a Wolf-Rayet star. Now I have a confession to make. When Janet Simpson from the UK sent me this, this is about when you and I first started communicating, Elizabeth, and you picked up some of these like in 2012 or 2011 or so. I couldn't remember what a Wolf-Rayet star was. Again, I'd read about them over the couple decades I'd been involved in astronomy, but you know, things do go in one ear and out the other. I know some of you have noticed that. And Wikipedia is our friend, you know, and a Wolf-Rayet star is a late stage star. It's enormous, headed probably to being a supernova. Some of the outer shell has been dissipated. We can see down, you know, in further into the star than we would normally see with a younger star. And intense stellar winds, which is why we can see these spectra here. Let's look at the graph. These peaks, these emission peaks, carbon, carbon, carbon. Why would we be seeing carbon in a star? Stars are made of hydrogen, right? Well, of course, stars are made of hydrogen, but they also fuse through the elements stepwise. And as part of that process, carbon comes into being. And that's what we're seeing here. Let's look at another. Oh, I was going to say, and this is definitely a ding moment, that this thing sort of bugs me. So I'm going to get rid of the ding and just talk about a ding moment. That when you get your hands on data, and even more so if it's your data, your whole relationship to it changes. You've seen that, right? For those of you who are imagers, think about that first image of the moon you captured. It was overexposed, it was underfocused, it might have been, poorly focused, smeared, you know, you weren't tracking, but it was the most beautiful astronomical image that you'd ever seen, I bet. And you showed it to your spouse, your friends, you know, and that's the deal. When it's your own, you really, as I said, have a different relationship. And what comes out of that is as you read things in different topics on different websites and books, you have a different relationship. You have a conceptual framework to hang them on. And so you end up remembering them more than you would otherwise. And that's been one of the things that spectroscopy has really helped me with. So, but let's look at another emission object, our beloved Ring Nebula. You can see there just two different emission lines. It's funny, only an astronomer would call these lines, they're circles, right? Hydrogen and oxygen, this Roman numeral three, we just say that it's ionized oxygen. Some of the electrons have been pulled out, no big deal. But most extended objects that aren't point sources aren't as interesting as this with a grating like this. And for that, we need to go to a much more expensive device. Not nearly as many people do that. You can see they're an order of magnitude more expensive. They get much higher resolution. They capture extended spectra of extended objects really well. But again, the slit in these things is like 20, 30, 40 microns. So now you're acquiring your target and tracking on a slit like that. Literally nobody, one in hundreds of people starts with something like this. It's too big a jump in terms of understanding as well as just technique. So, but here is a spectrum captured with a slit spectrometer of the Orion Nebula. You can see there's some hydrogen there. There's that Roman numeral three ionized oxygen. Interesting thing is that this is the birthplace of stars, and we're seeing those two elements as emission lines. And we saw the same two elements as emission lines on the Ring Nebula earlier. So I'm going to stop sharing my screen for just a moment here because I'm curious. I'd like to ask the group if anybody wants to step up. I won't call on anybody. If you don't want to step up, no big deal. For somebody just to share the first time they saw M42. What did it look like? What kind of telescope was on? What was your experience? Anyone? Bueller? Okay. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Well, I don't remember the first time I looked. It was probably 40 years ago. Probably an 8-inch telescope, Schmidt Cassegrain. It was a nice little fuzzy.
Yeah.
And I've been out in places, and I know that I've seen sort of where it's clear and dark enough skies where I have seen sort of a greenish glow from it.
Yeah. But, yeah. That's a pretty typical experience. And in fact, I mean, briefly, my experience was, it was in like the early 90s. I read about Shoemaker-Levy 9. I decided I wanted to do this astronomy thing. I'd never had or seen a telescope. I'd seen pictures of gorgeous photographs like this one in magazines. So I went to the Denver Astronomical Society first quarter star party in downtown Denver. You know, it's fun to remember before you understood something. And in this case, I got out of my car. I walked up on the very, 10-foot berm around the field at Chamberlain Observatory. And what I saw to my uneducated eye, those cannons at the circus that they shoot people out of? They also do it on America's Got Talent, I understand. But that's what I saw. Of course, they were daubs, but I didn't know any better. So I walked out onto the observing field. There was somebody, or there's several people, much like many of you or me, running their daub, talking about what they were showing, and they were looking at M42. I queued up all excited to see something like this. And what I saw was a smudge. I mean, honestly, I was really let down. But I still come back and look at M42. Why would that be if it's just a smudge? Well, of course, I'm observing in better dark sky sites. I've got better telescopes now. The other thing is, we've learned how to use averted vision so that we can observe objects that are, not in our direct line of sight. So, but I would say, the point of the silly story is, I would say that the reason that many of us come back to M42 is because we understand more about what we're looking at now, right? We understand that it's a stellar nursery, a birthplace of stars. The point is that when you bring that understanding to the eyepiece or to your visual imaging or to your reading in the field, whether it's in a magazine or a book or whatever, or online, that understanding that you bring enriches your experience. And so the astronomy and astrophysics that I've picked up, a little bit, not a lot, as I've had data, as I've captured data, or I had other people's data and I analyzed it in software, has really enhanced my whole experience of astronomy. Now, when I asked that for a story from the group, Elizabeth, yours was a good one. On occasion, I've had people tell the exact story I want, which was mine. And that was, I went out and it was a smudge and I thought, what the WTF, you know? The other end of the spectrum is sometimes I've had people say, oh yeah, I was on a 42-inch obsession, dark sky site. First time I ever looked at anything, and I could see all the colors and all. It's like, that wasn't the story I was looking for. Anyway, let's look at some additional examples here. So there is the spectra of Uranus and Neptune. And down here, you can see a deep absorption dip from that band. Well, you may recall a few minutes ago, I mentioned a band happens on a cool object where there can be complex molecules. So what kind of complex molecule do we see on Uranus and Neptune? Well, the methane atmosphere. Complex, not a simple element, and that's what we're seeing here. It's remarkable. This is done again with a video camera by Torsten Hansen. So in 1881, Henry Draper, the Draper catalog guy, captured the spectrum of a comet. Heck, if Hank can do it, so can we. So here's the spectrum in the lower left-hand corner here. You can see there are a nice string of gems, right? And over here, we can see the intensity plot, the Swan bands. Now, this was captured by a guy named Vikram Agnihotri. He's in Northwest India in Rajasthan. He's a nuclear power plant engineer. In 2013, he was a beginner. Now, he's like charged way past me in his understanding and his capabilities. What teacher doesn't like to see their students surpass them? I do a lot of teaching, a lot of, looking at images people capture because I love to do that, and I love to introduce people to the field. And he's one of my many success stories. The success is almost always your success, not mine. I just keep people on the yellow brick road until they get to wherever Dorothy got to, I guess the Oz. Anyway, bad analogy, I won't use it again. So here's another more timely image of the sodium lines from Comet Neowise. This is great. You know, anybody who uses a C-clamp, that's my kind of amateur. My problem is if I used a C-clamp, I'd break everything. Again, this is a ding moment. I mentioned that people think this is hard technically, but even something simple like this, I'd find a way to screw it up if there's one. I'd probably tighten that C-clamp too much and collapse the video camera housing here. Fortunately, Robin Ledbetter didn't. In fact, he's a designer of the Star Analyzer and a huge contributor to the field as well as to the community of RSpec and Star Analyzer users. And he used a video camera to capture the spectra of some Perseids. And there we can see that's the Perseid spectrum itself. And that's the zero order. That's the actual meteor. And there's the spectrum in mono. And that gap right there is this dip. So you can see he was able to identify some of the composing elements of that meteor. So this is a niche in a niche. This isn't something everybody does, but you know, whatever floats your boat. Some people love this. Robin does this and lots of other things too. I'm not going to talk a lot about the sun tonight. We've heard a lot and we'll be hearing a lot again about the sun as the next solar eclipse comes across North America. Just real briefly, in 1868, when they observed an eclipse, they saw this yellow line here at around 6,800 or so. They went to Bunsen's catalog, right? Bunsen had created his catalog just 10 years earlier. And his catalog didn't have anything that he had burnt that would create a yellow line at exactly this wavelength. They went, well, we don't know what it is. It's on the sun. So anyway, in Greek, the word for sun is helios. Let's call it helium, full stop. That would be the end of the story. There's something on the sun. We don't know what it is. We know something about it. It's got this yellow emission line. But now you fast forward 40, 50 years. A couple researchers were burning some gas to try and understand what it was. And they came up with the same yellow line. They were able to say, Eureka, wow, that stuff on the sun that we discovered 93 million miles away 50 years ago, we've now discovered it here. I love this story because it really illustrates how powerful spectroscopy is at observing unknown things at a distance. Really, really amazing. So if you're into novae, even with a DSLR, you can see here's one with a deep iron absorption band. This one has a very different graph. Quick review for Doppler shift, if you're not quite remembering what it is. And for those of you who teach this, my apologies, I ask your forgiveness. So basically Doppler shift, simple concept. The example is a train going through a station with its whistle on, you know, it goes, right? High as it's coming toward you, low as it's moving away. So as you're moving away, the pitch is lower. And as it's coming towards you or you're moving towards it, the pitch is higher. Same thing with light. Oh, by the way, a cool way to demonstrate Doppler shift, just roll down the window in your car next time you're driving. As trees or parked cars or cars going the other direction go past you, you'll hear that, right? That goes from high to low. That's Doppler shift. So if we were expecting with a spectrometer, with a star analyzer grading, to see this triplet, isn't that a great word, that word triplet? It's almost self-defining. But instead, we saw it shoved over to the right. Because it was red-shifted, we would know that that object was moving away from us. On the other hand, if it was shoved off to the left, then we'd know it was blue-shifted, right, towards the blue. And that would mean that the object was moving towards us. Let's look at a great example. So at the end of their lives, some stars go through an explosion, shall we say, of different sorts. So one is called a type 1A. And it's when two stars have been orbiting one another and one of the stars dumps some gas on the smaller star. When you pour gas on a hot surface, what happens? It explodes, right? So in M101, there's a supernova that occurred. There's a photograph of a similar type 1A supernova, not this one. This one, the one in this photograph here is in the Milky Way, but you can see that it sort of looks like there's a spherical shell of something. There's the spectrum. You can see a little gap there. Now, David Strange used a 9-inch Celestron, less than 15 minutes of integrating time. These are relatively dim objects because they're extragalactic mostly. And there is the graph of the spectrum he was able to create. And in fact, that little gap there shows up as that deep dip. Now, you know, it's an overused expression to talk about standing on the shoulders of giants, isn't it? But I tell you, a month ago when I got my first COVID vaccination, I said to he was a urologist of all things. I said to him as he was drawing that syringe to fill it, I said, that little drop, those drops in that syringe are the culmination. They're like at the top of this edifice of science that humanity has accumulated for hundreds or thousands of years. And right there in those drops is the fruits of that labor. The countless generations of scientists that labored, some going down blind dead ends in research that never produced any knowledge, except that don't go here. I didn't find anything of help. But the giants in studying supernovae figured out, just like the elements have spectral fingerprints, so do supernovas. And these particular supernovas, right, where you have two stars going around each other and they share some gas, produce a unique fingerprint. So here's a type 1A supernova. See that deep dip there? That is the silicon. None of these other supernovae, the others are mostly core collapse, where a star runs out of fuel and it just collapses on itself. They don't have that deep dip there. So that one of the ways that amateurs can help the professional communities is, in fact, Tim Puckett at a conference probably 5 years ago showed this document that had tons of supernovae that had never been identified as to their type. So amateurs can actually capture the spectra of supernovae. And if you see a deep dip around 6,000, you know it's a type 1A, and the professionals want to know that. That's the good news. The downside of all this is that these are extragalactic and they're really dim. So it's not like there's a lot of these that we can do with typical amateur equipment, but it is one way that we can contribute. So stick with me here. So David Strange and I noted that dip was at like at 6150 on the x-axis. And so we wrote that down. And then if Bunsen had burnt beach sand, he would have found that dip, that absorption feature at that wavelength. Now, the difference between those is Doppler shift. So, well, I couldn't remember the Doppler shift formula from high school, but Wikipedia is our friend. And when you plug the numbers in, you're able to detect that shell of that supernova, like this shell over here, is coming towards us at 22 million miles per hour. There should be several wows there. First, that's fast, wow. Second, I can't believe I did that on a small telescope without hours and hours of time. You know, when I speak in person at this point, sometimes I ask, does anybody have an astronomy or sky and telescope magazine? Pull it out, go to the back to the showcase, find some faint fuzzy that's gorgeous, and then read us the caption. And the caption, I mean, I love that these people capture these images, but the caption usually ends with something like, yeah, this was 20 hours of integration time. Listen, sometimes I'm in Seattle. Sometimes I don't even get a month with 20 hours or a summer even of 20 hours of dark skies here in Seattle. I don't have the skill, the knowledge, the equipment, the dark sky sight, or frankly, any interest in doing that kind of imaging. I'm glad these people do because they're gorgeous images. The reason I tell you this story is I think a lot of us are a little let down when we realize that we're not going to be able to capture a lot of the images we see in the magazines unless we're really at the top of the game of imaging. And I'm not showing you those images. I'm showing you images here that if you've captured the spectra of a faint fuzzy of, you know, the Ring Nebula or, you know, some other object or even planets, you can capture these images. This one requires some stacking, but most of everything I'm showing you doesn't. And then again, this is a ding moment because I think people go, well, that's all very well and good, but, you know, what misconceptions have we eliminated already? It's expensive. Nope. It's hard to set up. Nope. It requires expensive equipment, telescopes, mountaintops. Nope. So the one I want to eliminate here is that it requires lots of integration time. It doesn't. So you may recall that the Nobel Prize was won in 2011 for work done just before the turn of the century by Adam Riess and his team on the accelerating cosmological expansion. What type of star do you think they used as a standard candle? A type 1A supernova, type 1A supernovae. So somehow I don't think they used this particular piece of equipment, but in bang for your buck, that's a ratio, right? And the buck piece we've got really wired here at $200. So, but anyway, what about the spectrum of a black hole? Well, of course, a black hole doesn't emit light, but the accretion disk, as matter spirals down in, gets very hot and does. So David Hayworth in Portland, Oregon, observed 3C273, captured its spectrum. There's two little dots there. Let's zoom in on them. There they are there, and there is the intensity graph. So this guy, now again, normally when I'm in person, I'm just looking at the crowd. It's the same bunch of old elders like me. I don't see any kids here in the crowd, but when there's a teenager, I will, at this point, having already gotten their name and assuring them I wasn't going to call on them, point out that this guy, Martin Schmidt, was not much older than they are. Now to them, 25 years old was a lot older than even a teenager, but to us, 25, teenage, they're all the same age, right? Looking back, they're right next to each other. So when he looked at this, and there's a wonderful transcript of an interview, I'd be happy to send you the link to it. It's linked to on our samples page, where he describes the discovery process here. Like any scientist, he wanted to understand what he was seeing. And one approach is, well, let's compare an unknown to a known. And he brought up a calibration. Remember, this is that screen in my software I asked you to keep in your mind's eye. There's hydrogen, alpha, beta, gamma. That's where those absorption or emission lines would be if this object was composed of hydrogen. And he went, they don't match up. You know, all right, well, we've eliminated these lines being from hydrogen, except they were from hydrogen. And he figured it out. The amount of redshift here is so enormous using the Hubble constant, he was able to calculate that this object was 2 billion light years away. That's a long way away. So I don't know why I'm pointing, but so, the remarkable thing about it was that it was that far away, and yet we could still see it. That's how bright it was. In fact, and I think as amateurs, one of the things we delight in is doing this sort of macrocosmic expansion to how big things are. I know somehow at the same time that it makes us feel small, it doesn't make us feel meaningless. And maybe it makes our problems feel small. But here's two examples of the sort that we all enjoy. One is that for this to be as bright as it is, it would have to be at that distance, 100 times brighter than all of the stars in the Milky Way. The other example, I can't tell you how far away Pollux is, but well, you know, we know Pollux and all the stars are a long way away. But if this object was where Pollux is, it would be as bright as our sun. That gives us an idea as to how bright it is. So, you know, the amazing thing is that this light came over such a distance, over such a long time, long period of time, and yet there's still information in it that we can use to tease out something about the originating object. It's as if that light didn't age. That information is intact. Well, other things in the universe don't age as well. For example, here's Martin Schmidt a few years ago. He's changed a little. Look, I've been justly accused of throwing him under the bus with this image and these comparisons, but he's got a full head of hair. I'm envious of the guy. You know, give me a break. Okay, two final examples and we'll finish up. First of all, we've been looking at absorption features, these hydrogen and other features of Vega and other stars. And how wide is that? That's about, you know, it's about 50 angstroms. Suppose we wanted to drill down and zoom in. Wouldn't it be nice if we could just use our mouse roller wheel and just zoom in? It doesn't work that way, right? I mean, remember back to the first time you looked at the moon with your own gear. You probably, like me, went, I want to see those crater details in more detail. I'll just put more magnification in my telescope. But you get to a point where it's just empty magnification. There's just no more data you can extract given all the factors that are going into what you're seeing. And it's the same thing here with zooming with a mouse. So in order to drill down into those details, you need to use one of those much more expensive slit spectrometers. I just want to show you the kinds of things professionals do. So here is Vega. That's, again, the hydrogen alpha feature, that feature. Let's compare it to another object that we know, and that is the moon. Now, the moon's not moving towards or away from us appreciably. So that difference there is Doppler shift. Vega, that we're actually measuring the radial velocity of Vega. Now, again, it takes one of these expensive devices. But this is the kind of thing that amateurs do. Now, I've got one last example to finish up, and I've got a visual aid here, so bear with me here it is. So this is a star that's rotating, okay? Stick with me here. So this edge is coming towards you. And so that light is blue shifted a little bit because of this is a really fast rotating star. And this edge is moving away from you. So that light is a little red shifted. So we have with the collection of light coming towards you, some's red shifted, some's blue shifted, and some in the middle isn't shifted at all because this rotation speed isn't really moving towards or away from you right here. Not a great explanation, but let's stick with it. So here's what I just described. The edge coming towards you as it's rotating this way is blue shifted. The light here is red shifted. So rather than this slowly rotating Vega absorption feature, on a fast rotator like Altair, look how broadened it is. Some of the light that would normally be down here got spread out to the red and the blue wings. So the giants really are brilliant. They figured out that who would think that you could tell how fast a distant object is rotating by just looking at its color through a prism-like device. So how do you get started really quickly here? Star analyzer grading, which we talked about, any sort of camera, almost any camera. I want to change the order of these. You may need a spacer or two, and that's because this distance, while not critical, needs to be within a certain range. And well, again, maybe I won't change those orders next time because I'm going to come back to software for a second. This is mine called RSpec. R stands for real time. You can do real time with video. You can have real time images pop into the software. This is that software I tried early on. Still brilliant software, just remarkably great people. I'm friends with the authors from France, but still, you know, tough to use. Adding a spacer or two here, my site has a little calculator where you plug in your telescope and camera specs, and then we just look for some green flags over here. A lot of people just click on this link and email me their specs, and then I fill in the calculator and make a quick screen video and tell them whether they need to buy, you know, an extra spacer here to insert between the grating and the sensor. So there's lots of great books out there. This one's a pretty cool one. And these are all linked to on my site. And this one, the Spectral Atlas for Amateurs, here's a sample page. You know, I've mentioned repeatedly that, you know, I'm not a whiz kid. And I don't know the significance of the things I see with my telescope, whether with or without a grating. This thing shows me what to expect. And then it actually has a description where it explains what I'm seeing in easy English. That wasn't a deliberate call. This is not written for postdocs or undergraduates. This is written for people like you and me. It's a great book. And by the way, I missed one of the important ding moments I meant to mention long ago. Even if you're not planning to ever do spectroscopy, maybe you're an armchair astronomer, maybe you just read and go to meetings and that's all you really want out of it. Still, I'm hoping that as you've listened to me tonight, you've gained a new appreciation for what's possible, and then that will deepen your experience of what can be done by amateurs. We've got a great online forum. And the reason I talk about armchair astronomers is because about 4 years ago, I gave an in-person workshop to the AAVSO to about 100 members. I gave an online one, I guess last October or so, but this one 4 years ago in person at the SAS conference in LA, 100 amateurs with their laptops and sample data, and we walked through the data pipeline. I feel like an adult when I use that term. So we have a YouTube video of that presentation. And if you go to the download page on my site, you can download not only the software free for 30 days, also the sample data from that workshop. And there's a link there to the YouTube video. So tomorrow morning, Sunday morning, even if you never plan to do any imaging with spectra, you could download all that stuff and you could walk through the process of capturing spectra and then processing it. And when you were done, you would have it. I'm not saying you'd have muscle memory, but it would be in your bones, you know, to mix metaphors. You'd really have a good sense for how we extract this information by having done it yourself. There are opportunities for Pro-Am collaboration. Stella Kafka, the current great executive director at the AVSO, and Arnie, her predecessor, they're professional astronomers. They know how important spectroscopy is. The AAVSO recently has ramped up in the last year or so. They have an online database for spectra, much like their photometry database. That's starting to get used by professionals. To be honest, there aren't as many opportunities as many of us would like. I think they're coming as more amateurs get into the field. It does take a while to get up to speed, and especially if you want to do high resolution work. But it's the kind of thing that there are opportunities for us. So in the last 200 or 300 years, in the last, oh my God, almost 60 minutes, we've come a long way. I apologize for running a little long. I'd like to thank you all for smiling at some of my jokes. And I love answering questions, whether you ask them now, whether you ask them via the contact form on our site or via email. You can Google my name or just Star Analyzer or RSpec and find me. It's pretty easy. I'd like to thank you all for inviting me. And for those of you who do outreach, the last and not only not least, but most important, I'd like to thank the people in the club who do outreach. You know, and you all know this, but it bears repeating sometimes, and that is, we all are privileged. And the reason we can, we know that is because you're here tonight, as am I. And we understand and value these topics. We had opportunities which we were able to take advantage of. And by doing outreach, we give back to the community. And unlike some giving, which hurts, this kind of giving is really a pleasure once we get comfortable doing it. So I'd encourage you to, for those of you who aren't doing it, as things open up this fall and maybe this summer or even spring, I'm hoping, I guess that was a Freudian slip that I said fall. I'm hoping by June, we're gonna be out and about and feeling a lot more relaxed. I hope some of you maybe go out with some others in the club who have done it before, get your riff down so you can talk about it, because it is a lot of fun and it's a way of paying it forward and paying it backwards. Again, thank you all for listening tonight. I'll stop sharing my screen for now and we can get into questions. Go for it.
Henry?
Yes, I've got two comments. First of all, Nancy Roman was a member of our club.
Pardon me?
Nancy Roman was a member of our club.
Really?
Yes, she was.
Wow. So was Vera Rubin.
Has anybody done any spectrometry on Betelgeuse?
Wow, that's pretty cool. See, out here in Seattle, you know, we're such a young place that we don't have any of that. I can talk to you about the Paul Bunyan tree chopping contest that went on back then, but not astronomy. Did you have something else you wanted to say? Did you have two things?
The next question. The next question was: has anybody done any spectrometry on Betelgeuse?
In fact, we, in our webinar Zoom session this morning, people were looking at Betelgeuse. There's lots to see. People are using Betelgeuse as sort of a test object to look at the resolution and performance of their equipment. There are a lot of Betelgeuse spectra out there for sure. There's always room for more though.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for the questions. And you're welcome, Manjunata. Manjunat, I think that's it. Manjunat, I can read Sanskrit, so I apologize for mispronouncing your name. I can, actually. Other questions?
No, thank you. You pronounced it correctly. Thanks.
Oh, thank goodness. Open mouth, change feet. I'm glad that you can't see how I'm blushing here, like sweat's rolling off my head. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you. It was a wonderful lecture. I enjoyed it.
Well, thanks. And by the way, I mentioned India. India has just a remarkable community of scientists and a heritage of science that goes back far further than I think most of us are aware of. Back centuries and centuries, they knew things astronomically in terms of allegedly, and I believe it, but it's just a belief on my part, being able to predict eclipses and so forth. Just really amazing stuff. But back to the topic, other questions that people may have? That's it? Hi, Jeff.
Oh, hi. Well, if no one else is going, I will. I've got a couple questions. But first of all, let me mention that Nancy Grace Roman was not only a member of NCA, but a very active member. There, she regularly attended the meetings for many years, contributed to our newsletter, and at the meetings, she would always ask questions that that went right to the heart of some issue, and she would always hold the speakers to the units on the axes of their plot. If they forgot the units or she couldn't read what they were, she would speak up and ask the speaker there what the units were. But getting to my questions, first of all, to get the Doppler shift, you would need to calibrate the spectrum somehow. So I'm curious how you achieve that.
That's an excellent question. It's something I glossed over, not to hide it deliberately, but because it's just a little bit TMI. When I was at that point of the presentation. But for those of you who are interested, just real briefly, I'll show you. And that is that here's a spectrum that normally, speaking of axes, it's great that you brought that up. This x-axis is in pixels, right? My camera was 1300 pixels across. That's from here to here. So the great thing about this grading is that it's linear dispersion. So if we know 2 points here, we're done calibrating. We'll now be able to read wavelengths off instead of pixel units. And the great thing is that we've got this 1 point here. This is the starlight. This peak is the starlight that went right through the grating. So it's not deflected at all. So that's our zero order. So let's put that pixel value like 155 and zero in. This is, and now we just need to know one other point. We're halfway home to being able to calibrate our data. And for that, we image a type A star, and we just need to have a little bit of experience or knowledge or trial and error, all of which is shown in the tutorial videos in the product. And by the way, under video library, as well as on the web, you could look at it tonight, are tutorial videos. There's not some 400 page manual you've got to read. These walk you through the steps that I'm showing you here, and this is the specific step I'm showing you. We just have to know that this particular feature is a type A, on a type A star, it's gonna be our hydrogen alpha, our beta, excuse me. So we put that wavelength in there. And when we click apply, watch how this axis goes to angstroms. Now, unless we change the position of this grating with reference to the sensor, we never have to do what I just did again. We now know our dispersion. I mean, again, just a little bit more math for those of you who are interested. This is just y equals mx plus b. These are the 2 points, and this is m. And what's b? This point. So as long as we can see the star in subsequent images, we're good to go. It's a great question. Thanks for paying attention and asking about that.
My second question then is, you showed us some spectra of planets and comets. The comet, I believe, was taken with a star analyzer. It wasn't clear to me what the planets were taken with, but in both cases, those are extended objects. So that would tend to smear out the spectra along its length.
Yeah.
Right?
Boy, that's a really great question. And I don't know, Jeff, are you an educator or a teacher?
No, I'm professionally a computer programmer.
Okay.
Majored in astronomy in college many years ago.
The reason I ask is
because even longer than that.
Elizabeth is sitting there, and I don't know, is it Harold or Harry? I'm not sure which it is. As an educator, the two of them are educators, and they're sitting there going, they know exactly what I'm thinking, and that is, you can really tell by the questions people ask that they're tracking, and that's a really excellent question. You are correct. Earlier in my presentation, I said that with a grating, you can't really look at extended objects, and then I showed you some extended objects with star analyzer spectra. It turns out the planets I showed you are more or less compact, right? They're just distant nebula, distant almost point sources. So, but the comets, if you have a compact,
Neptune, not like Jupiter.
Exactly. You can't do Jupiter without a slit. Okay. But the comet, as it turns out, the features in comets are so broad that even though the comet is extended, if it has a relatively compact core, or if you're just looking at the tail, which is pretty narrow, then you can get away without using the grating. Those are really excellent questions. I appreciate you asking them. Other questions?
Okay, thank you.
Sure. You know, while people are working on their questions, I wanted to show you a quick video here. This is pretty neat. Let me bring it over here. So this is Albireo A and B. And here, let's make sure I don't have anything which embarrasses me up here. I think we're pretty clean, you know? It looks like I'm looking into doing some traveling coming up. Not far from you all here. I know you're going, this is supposed to be astronomy. This is a live camera of an eagle's nest, and it's not far from you all. It's wherever the national, 75 miles from DC. And this is a live, it's a night cam here, but when its eggs hatch, you're gonna see live eagles. It's just fun. But back on topic. So this is Albireo A and B. This is actually a video. It's mono, so we have a little more sensitivity than we have with color. And over here is the intensity graph. It's been corrected for my camera's color response, and we can talk about that later if you're interested in it, but let's play this video. Again, things are jumping around, right? Because my seeing is changing, but notice that a lot more of the energy, let's pause that, a lot more of the energy is over here in the hot blue end for Albireo B, because it's a really hot star. Now, in a moment, you're going to see when I start the playback, we move the sampling lines around the other of the two Albireos. And now we're seeing that most of the data, most of the light is over here in the cooler red end because this is a cool star. This isn't the way professionals detect star temperature. This is a Planck-like curve, but it is a way that we can approximately often tell the temperature of a star. This is, again, a little bit more detail that as you start capturing spectra, you start getting curious about, you know, what type of star is this? And this is a tool that you can experiment with to learn a little bit about what you're seeing. Okay, other questions anybody might have, Elizabeth?
Sue, do you have a question?
I just wanted to comment how much I appreciated this because it fits right in with a little issue I have been researching. And so I found this very helpful.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that. Thanks for saying something, Sue. I really appreciate it. It is a little hard not being in person. I can sort of see you, but then I got to look over to the side. And then, you know, it's much more fun in person. Other questions people might have?
Jay?
Just a comment. I'm pretty sure you can expect some sales from Montgomery College and probably from the University of Maryland. And I wouldn't be surprised if you get some sales from some other people in your audience. Sue was also a member of another club that has a much nicer telescope than I have access to, but really, really cool. This was really, really good.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. Thank you. I wanted to show you just a moment here. There it is. So if you're an educator, Elizabeth, I don't know if you have our gas tube spectrometer, but it's the same software for gas tubes, but instead of using those really frustrating handheld glasses that everybody has trouble finding the spectrum in, or those little triangular plastic spectrometers, this puts it up on the overhead. So you might go to field-tested systems and take a look and see, because one of the really cool projects that we worked on with the University of North Texas, and other schools have done it too, and that is the students capture some spectra of gas tubes. Then they go outside. And in this case, at the University of North Texas, they have some C8 set up with TAs acting as telescope operators. So these teams of undergraduate Astro 101 liberal arts students hand their thumb drive to the TA and they get a 5 or 10 second video of Vega, which is what this is. They then go inside and compare that to their gas tubes and they discover for themselves the hydrogen. Now, that's pretty cool, but the most amazing fact to me is they run 2,200 students a year in normal years when things are open through that lab. I can't even imagine that number of people. They have a lab every night going on. So that's the kind of thing, and I'm always happy to brainstorm or talk with people because, you know, whether you're an educator, and it's a relatively small number of you who are, but I'll tell you, I mentioned star parties and doing this at star parties, and I'm going to show you a video in a moment of another star party tool. But the other thing, as an amateur astronomer, there's not a lot that we can do with a local school. Yeah, we can go in and, you know, set up on the football field and show them the moon or show them some show pieces. But you can now, with a tool like this, you can go to an astronomy or, frankly, a chemistry or a physics professor, and you can say, I've got some really cool tools. We can show gas tube spectra in the classroom. We can show spectra outside and compare them so the students understand. This really expands the coverage of a class beyond their little niche. And a lot of professors love this. So it's something which you could, again, bring value to the table if you wanted to get involved in an educational institution. The other video I wanted to show you is for daytime outreach. Now, a lot of us have hydrogen alpha telescopes. I've got one and I love it, but I can't service the crowds that show up. And I wanted to ask, since I'm on the topic, do you all participate in that astronomy on the mall thing that happens every summer? Jay does.
Yes.
Do others? Good.
I volunteer at the Air and Space Museum.
Oh, no, that's cool. That's really neat.
And I run NCA's outreach program.
I've contributed to the mall thing, yes.
Cool. I can't remember the name of the guy from New Jersey who organizes it. Great guy.
It's Long Island.
Long Island. I recognize the accent. Yeah. What's his name? I can't remember.
Starts with an L. Wayne knows him personally.
Leibowitz or something.
Yeah, that's it. Wayne knows him personally.
He's a great guy, and what an amazing event. But during the day when we have our hydrogen alpha telescopes up, it would be nice to be able to augment it with, again, maybe a little more science. So there is a solar spectrometer that's incredibly easy to use. And I'm going to show you a really bad video I made for a friend. You'll see what I mean by bad in just a moment. There is the spectrometer. It's on a tripod. You don't even need any tracking. It's got an eyepiece. You can see it's made by Shellyak. There's a gnomon. You just point it at the sun and it's fine. There's a little hole up here on this face that works for quite some time without repointing. Now, this is a slit spectrometer, so you just see a small piece of a much longer spectrum. And what this little dial lets you do is change where you're looking at the spectrum, which color you're looking at. And right now, it's tuned to magnesium. Magnesium, there's a well-known, it's a triplet. It's three lines that occur, and it's way over my pay scale to understand why there's three. It's quantum mechanics, but they're well-known. And there's also a magnesium or a sodium doublet. So let's see what they look like. Now, this is like the worst video you can imagine. I'm literally just holding my iPhone up to the eyepiece. But I want you to see the colors are gorgeous, even more impressive in person. And there is a magnesium triplet. Now, what we're going to do in this video here is just move that little lever and you'll see me moving to other colors. And there, it's a continuous color transition. There's our hydrogen alpha. I really don't do service to it. I'm not trying to sell it. If I was, I'd be doing a terrible job. I don't sell these. And the other example I'd like to show you here, there's the sodium doublet. So this is all something you could do. It comes in a small case. It's so easy to set up. Everything's good about it, except the last thing I'm about to tell you. And that is it costs about $1,400. So you can buy a heck of a lot of hydrogen alpha telescope for $1,400. But
as I said, I volunteered Air and Space, and we have one of those. And in business, we would regularly use that, because we were normally open during the day looking at the sun. And that's one of the objects, one of the pieces of equipment we used.
I'm really curious what you thought of it, Jay. Again, I'm glad trying to sell one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, great, yes.
They are great. And they, again, act as a platform that you can talk a little bit about the science and just get a little beyond just the aesthetics of what people are seeing. Of course, with the sun, there's plenty to talk about.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jay. Other comments or questions from the group?
Some of us even understand the Zeeman splitting in magnesium.
And I'm impressed if you do. That's neat. Very cool. And that, again, illustrates that you learn as much as you need or care to know. There's no quizzes for us amateurs. Again, probably tonight I'll be going out trying to at least get a better idea so I don't get quite as flat-footed caught next time we talk about the triplet. Anyway. This is a great group and wonderful questions. Are there any other questions before we finish up for the night?
Yeah, I have a question about, okay, you sell the R Spectra for 109.
Yeah.
You sell the star thing for 200.
Yeah.
But you have more than one analyzing piece of software, right? What was the other one?
Well, the software really is just the RSpec software. There's some freeware out there. It's called VSpec, V-S-P-E-C, and ISIS, an unfortunate name choice that goes back a decade or more. But I think, I mean, if I was really paranoid, I wouldn't be talking about competitors, but I'm comfortable that there's a lot of people, educators and not, who have tried the freeware and then used my stuff and go, you know, oh, I don't need the headaches of the freeware, but they are free. So the only software that I have available is the RSpec software. It's for either astronomical spectra or the same software works with our tripod spectrometer in the classroom for students.
What is that? Because I'm also the physics lab coordinator for the college, and we're desperately trying to find ways to put online exactly what you're doing.
Well, this works well for that. This is at fieldtestedsystems.com, and there's a video at the top that will show you how it works. And this would be something that would easily be used for remote teaching.
What does that cost?
This is $395 with the software. So
I can guarantee you've just made a sales.
Oh, good. Hey, now my time's worth it.
We'll pay for it, but that. Thank you.
Sure, my pleasure. Listen, there's a contact form on the site. You know, the only regret I have is in turning this into a business. And if any of you have ever turned a hobby into a business, you're familiar with what I'm about to say. I always feel a little bit like people are going, oh, he's just trying to make a fast buck. And so it's a pleasure to be able to talk about a product like, for example, that Shelyak device that Jay was familiar with for solar spectra that I don't sell. So I've got no skin in the game talking about how great it is. But anyway, listen, I'd like to thank all of you tonight.
Tom, if you one more question.
Sure. I'm here forever. Go ahead. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
David.
Oh, David, go ahead.
This is a rather general question. What mystery have you run into that bothers you or absorbs you the most in what you've been doing?
That is a fantastic question. That's the kind of question I like asking people. I'll ask my doctors that question and then they start looking at their watch. You know, I asked my optometrist 2 days ago, I said, what invention would change your profession totally? What would you like? And his answer was really a boring one. And it was, he's sitting at a terminal typing in all his results. He says, I don't want to type anymore. You know, I said, well, let's get somebody in here to transcribe. He says, no, there's not funding for that. So he wants something he can dictate to. The technology is there for it, but the obstacles, the barriers to entry for medical software are very steep. David, I don't have, that's all by way of saying, I don't have an easy answer for you. I think the thing that, it's not a mystery, but the thing that's, that fascinates me is that the phenomena that we're studying are occurring at this subatomic level, these electrons jumping around. And the fact that we, with these coarse, macrocosmic, relatively, eyes, are able to detect and study things from that are phenomena at that level. And having said that, then I look around and go, what is that around us? Every color we're seeing is because of some, you know, molecular level kinds of interaction with light. So that fascinates me more than anything. I'm going to think about it, David, and I'll email Elizabeth with my answer and she'll forward it to you. It's a great question. You caught me. Let me think for a second. Any other questions while I contemplate that?
And I really want to thank you. And I like the handheld stuff with the lines that gives it a more of a living sense rather than you know the professional makeup stuff that you show on the screen. That's the kind of stuff that you have more of, or you actually discover when you're actually out there, when the rubber meets the road.
Absolutely. Am I still sharing my screen? I think I'm not.
Yes, you are.
Oh, good. Okay. So I think the thing that most excites me is being able to have a screen like this live under the stars. It astonishes me that I can sit in my backyard. I used to have a line in my presentation when I was talking about discovering the atmosphere of Uranus and Neptune about how professional astronomers would give their left leg, and with that deliberate pause, to be able to do that kind of thing 30, 40 years ago with such inexpensive equipment. This is this kind of color and movement at a star party or at a public outreach event is really remarkable. And the thing I like about video, of course, video is not as sensitive as static images. And by the way, just a rule of thumb, when we normally image stars, the photons from the star fall on a handful of pixels, right? Depending on our full width half maximum, but not very many. Now, if you put a grating in the light path, you've taken the same total number of photons and spread them out across hundreds of pixels. So you lose five or six magnitudes. So if normally you can image down to mag 12, then now you'll be able to image down to say mag 6 or so. So you do lose a lot of light, but for me, the live nature of video when I'm educating is so different. Again, for those of you who come from, as I do, from the punch card age, I can remember carrying around boxes of punch cards and waiting hours to find out I forgot to put a semicolon in at the end of a line. Sounds like some of you have done that too. So, and to me, static imaging is like punch cards when you're trying to teach. It's like, especially these days, our attention spans and our expectations are so shortened, the attention span, that to be able to show something live instead of saying, oh, okay, well, give it 30 seconds. Okay, it's coming up now. Okay, you see that? That's very different. It's deeply different. It's not just a matter of a few seconds. And so that's the excitement I get from the R and the real-time spectroscopy. But as I said, if you want to do static images, you can do static images too. Other questions before I go up and get some dinner? Right, don't hold back.
I just want to make one little
round of applause.
Thank you so much. I love what I do, and it's audiences like you that make a difference. So thank you so much again.
Jay, you had something you wanted to do.
Oh, good.
I was going to make a comment. As I said, I run NCA's outreach program in one of the local parks, and you gave me a very good idea. I've got one of your RSpec filters, taking that and finding a way to put it maybe on an iPad and using that to give, because we usually have, you know, maybe four or five telescopes, maybe taking one of them and just using that for something like this. I think that this would add a little bit more to the outreach.
It really does. You'll be the star of that particular unit with all the color and movement. It will be very interesting to the public.
Yeah, thank you for the idea.
Oh, my pleasure. Again, in terms of getting started and set up, if you're thinking about buying stuff, or in your case, Jay, you've already got it, I'm always available for you to call me and say, now, what do I need to do to actually use this thing? You know, is it just screwing it on? Be lazy and reach out to me and I'll get you going. Anyway, have a great evening, everybody. Thanks for everything that you do, both astronomically and not, to help us be a great country and the successes that we'll be having as years go by. Thanks again. Good evening to you. And I'm frantically trying to find where to hang up.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Good night.
Members, y'all are welcome to stay on to go over any business type stuff, because we didn't do that at the beginning. So I don't know if Harold has any other business.
A little bit, not much.
To discuss or whatever. So
I'm sure.
Yeah, Tom, you might want to stop sharing because we're seeing your desktop.
I know.
Okay.
There you go.
In terms of business, Jack, when is the next physics meeting for those people that are interested in that?
The senior physicists, yeah.
Did Jack still hear?
Jack,
yeah, he's there.
Jack, tell us when the next senior physics meeting is, and what's the subject?
Okay, I need to unmute.
We can hear you.
Right. The next APS senior physicist meeting will be Wednesday, March 24. That's the fourth Wednesday, rather than the usual third Wednesday. The speaker will be Larry Nittner from the Carnegie Institution of Washington Department of Terrestrial Magnetism. And he will talk about analyzing supernova dust in the solar system. Ah. There is a link to both an abstract and a link to the website on page 7 of Stardust.
Joan, do you have anything to tell us about coming occultations in the Washington metro area? If you are down even here, in the Washington metro area at the moment, not in Arizona.
No.
Okay.
I'm unmuted, but I can't get the video to start. Oh, well, we'll talk without the video. Sorry. Yeah,
I can hear you.
Yeah. I don't know why it's not. Whatever.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, there's, well, you can see the list in the Stardust for the things coming up.
Thank you.
We did have a remarkable success last weekend where we traveled to Louisiana with 8 small telescopes and set them up along Highway 165 south of Oakdale, Louisiana, at 100 meter intervals, along with other IOTA people who are set up. And it turned out 2 of our telescopes captured an occultation of an 1/8 magnitude star by Apophis, the asteroid Apophis that we had predicted. We only knew about the occultation a week before or so, but we scrambled and got a whole big IOTA expedition to go there. We had to juggle the weather and everything, but it was clear in that area. And in addition, another observer, IOTA member, was between our two stations. We were actually 200 meters apart, and then he was between us, halfway between us, and he was the first to analyze the event, and then we analyzed both of our ones on the sides, and we got the same time of this very short blip. It was just a couple of video frames, all it was, because Apophis is pretty small in terms of the asteroids we do. In the meantime, we were able to get the prediction well enough to set up a line of observers spread over about 0.5 mile to capture this from the radar observations that are just being made during the closest approach of the asteroid. So the so we got it narrowed down within that range, and then by spreading. We had a total of about 24 stations spread out across the uncertainty zone, which was actually almost a mile wide or so. And
is someone going to do like a short write-up about some of that stuff? Because we do have the Apophis campaign, and I'm sure they'll be interested in hearing a quick summary and stuff. They asked me about it at the last meeting, and so I tried to tell what I could and show the Occult Watcher stuff. But yeah, they'll probably be interested in an update.
Yeah. I'm actually have an abstract in and a talk I have to prepare, a whole presentation and a paper. For the Planetary Defense Conference that's being held online. There was one a couple of years ago in College Park, you might remember. It's held online this year. And that's due in late April.
Right.
So it's great we got this result, because it's the topic of the paper was occultations by near-Earth asteroids.
Right.
So we were happy to get this. And in addition, now the JPL people were ecstatic because they have both this their radar observations, which are line of sight, getting very accurate distances to the object. But now they also have a plane of sky fix on it extremely accurately relative to the Gaia position of the star that was occulted. The star that was occulted, by the way, happened to be a variable star, but just a very small range called NY Hydri. but it turns out there's going to be another occultation by Apophis, a little fainter star this time, a 10th magnitude one, on March 22nd, about 5 hours UT. The path for it goes from Florida to Illinois. I've just made, we happen to be traveling anyway right at that time to come back to Maryland. We'll be spending most of April in Maryland. The timing is just right for the flight. So we're going to stop in Atlanta and then observe this occultation and then go on to Baltimore a day or two later. So hopefully we'll get another success with this and see what happens. But if anyone is on that line from Florida to Illinois, I mean, it passes over Orlando, it passes over Nashville, and so it's just the accuracy now of the orbit from this down, we decrease the accuracy of the orbit. One sigma accuracy is 26 meters.
Wow.
So I think we might say we saved the planet, or at least we know what the danger is, because since we got the one occultation, we keep getting them in the future, then we can keep track of the asteroid and measure its Yerkovsky effects and other small things extremely accurately. We did that with the asteroid Phaethon, and that was what I was going to mainly talk about before we got the success with this even smaller object. Because Phaethon is about a 5 kilometer object, and Apophis is only about 350 meters in size. So it will be interesting to see what happens for the next event and on in the future. We'll be able to follow it all the way up to the close encounter in 2029, when there are some space encounters planned.
Yep.
Are there any more announcements for the good of the order before I report that I'm happy that in late February a roof fell down at Tacoma and saved the college a lot of money?
Okay. I wanted to mention, I put it in the chat, that NEEF will be having its online meeting this year on April 10th.
Please send us all notifications. Some of us will want to go.
Yeah. Well, you don't go. You just online.
Go via Zoom.
There is some confusion about that because they have not taken down the web pages that originally announced that it was going to be the 10th and 11th today in-person meeting. So that if you go just check on NEEF, you get these two different, very different meetings, and it's kind of hard to tell which one is the real one. I don't know what's with the Rockland Astronomy Club that don't take the bad one there.
Probably because they don't have somebody like Elizabeth around.
Yeah. I guess. Okay, I'll turn off.
So there's that poses a little bit of a problem if too many members end up hanging out and watching the NEEF going on till 8 o'clock and our meeting starts at 7:30.
I know, that is a problem. And IOTA is going to be having a website in connection with that meeting. So I don't know if we'll have anything to do with it. I mean, if it's any reason to be online at that time or not, but we will be in Maryland.
Okay.
You're in Arizona now?
Yes.
Okay. I see, Michael, that you've got your camera working. We're not meeting on Monday. We're meeting on Wednesday. I'll email you about that.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. All your new equipment is working. Are you using
it? Yes. Hi. This is the first time I tried Zoom. It works perfectly.
Okay. I told you it would.
Yeah, of course.
We're meeting on Wednesday. We're not meeting on Monday.
Okay. Wednesday then. Fine. Yeah. Send me an email again.
Yeah, I will. Is there any other announcements before we can all go home? Well, we're already home. Before we can turn off our cameras.
Michael, I want you to stay. Michael Probonsky, I need you to stay for a minute.
Yes, I saw your message. We'll have to talk and see if we can make an appointment with each other.
Yeah, sure. Stay for a little longer. Stay for a little longer. We can talk about it.
Yeah, okay. I'll send you an email.
Very good. I've got a ton of them. I want to pass them out to you. I don't want to throw them out.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Have there been any people signing up for NCA membership?
No, we've very, very little, just a few, just a very few. It's been you know, COVID-19 has been very difficult.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm using last year's email list, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to send you an update. There's only two or three new ones.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, anytime you get any new ones, just send them on to me. Let me know.
Keep you in touch.
What does membership cost?
$10. But what's the fiest wave for this year?
I'm in.
Because we're rich enough. I mean, why?
And one other thing. Happy birthday, Elizabeth.
Oh.
Elizabeth, is your birthday?
Yeah.
Oh, happy birthday.
Right. Yes, happy birthday, Elizabeth.
Okay.
We need to sing.
Thank you, Chuck.
Michael, we'll be in touch.
Yes.
Well, see you next month. A few of you sooner, at least via Zoom.
See everybody. Michael will be in touch, right?
Yes. I'll send you an email. It's essentially, we have to just agree on a time, and I can maybe drive down there.
There are a ton of them, and you'd really appreciate it. There are a ton of them. I've got them all saved.
Yeah, okay. And if I can park for a minute or two, then I'll bring some boxes and stuff, okay?
Good, very good, very good. This panel, yes, very good. Oscar Zeichnet.
Okay,
I'm ready to leave, so I'm gonna leave.
All right,
anybody else?
We'll see you next
Night.
Bye. Bye-bye.